It is the Soccer Central podcast. Hope you're doing really well. I'm James Sharman, joined as usual on Monday by John Molinaro of Sportsnet.ca. Another fascinating weekend of football action. We'll get to the Prem story later. We'll also talk some Serie A with Adam Digby. But to begin with, J-Mo, we're crossing the channel, as it were.
We are. We're pleased to welcome back an old friend of the show in Matt Spiro. Matt is a Paris-based reporter who covers Ligue 1 and French football for a number of media outlets around the world. And Canadian TV viewers will probably recognize Matt's voice as he hosts the Ligue 1 show that airs on BN Sports. Matt has been kind enough to take time out of his schedule to talk to Soccer Central, and he joins us now on the phone from Marseille in the south of France. Mr. Spiro, how are you, sir?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. Marseille is a little bit damp. It's a bit wet, and the enthusiasm of the early months of the season has been dampened by the defeat in the Classique last night. But Marseille gave a good account of themselves, so they're not feeling too sort of downhearted. But they played really well, and from that point of view, it's disappointing, frustrating that they didn't get a result in Paris last night.
Well, and that's where I wanted to start. I mean, a 2-0 win for PSG at the Parc des Princes. What were your general observations of the game and on the performance on both sides?
Well, I think all in all, it was a really, really good game of football. Really intense and high quality. It's been a while since I sort of have seen a Ligue 1 game of that quality. I watched Arsenal against Swansea just before, and it's rare that you kind of flick from the Premier League to Ligue 1. I think that the standard has gone up, but on those two games, definitely PSG Marseille at the Parc des Princes was a notch up, and it's fantastic for Ligue 1 what is happening at Marseille at the moment. It really looked as though it was going to be a procession this season again for PSG. It may yet turn out to be a procession, but Marseille have found this fantastic sort of cohesion and intensive way of playing. I use that word intensity because it's something that Marcelo Bielsa has really managed to instill in his players. And in that first half at the Parc des Princes, Marseille were the better team, and they hit the post. They had a few chances, a few shots that went just wide, and then what was ultimately a killer blow just before halftime, defensive mistake, and Lucas Moura scored, and Marseille struggled to sort of emulate their first half performance after the break.
And it is refreshing, I think, to see Marseille back to where they should be, and that is competing for championships, and obviously another little flavour for the league with PSG's dominance in recent years. I want to talk about Edinson Cavani, please, Matt. Now, obviously at PSG, he gets signed, the Matador, fantastic in the Serie A. Wow, him and Ibra can't miss, right? Well, it'd been a pretty poor, relatively poor start for him, I guess, to his career at PSG. But the last five games, five goals, he seems to have really hit that switch at the right time.
Yeah, he has. He scored in each of his last five games. They've mainly been scrappy goals, good header against PSG. And, you know, frankly, who cares if it's a scrappy goal, because they've generally been quite important. He got the winner in the Champions League against Apoel. He's got some important league goals. But for me, he's still a long way off being the player that we thought he would be. And in fact, in the first few months at PSG, he really won everyone over with his fantastic work ethic. But not just that. Also, you know, his quality with the ball and his quality in front of goal. We're still not seeing that Edinson Cavani resurface. You know, it's been the whole of 2014 has been a pretty dismal year for him. He had that injury at the end of last calendar year, and he hasn't really been back to his best. And you worry, okay, 5-5, you can't really argue with that. You know, he's doing well, but the fact is, Ibra is back now, and you saw last night he came on for 20 minutes. Of course, Ibra has sort of the centre forward position marked out as his own, but has a freedom to go wherever he wants, and Cavani has to play on one of the flanks. And he did score the goal when Ibra was on the pitch. Ibra started the move with a good ball up the right to Aurier, who crossed, and it was a good header from Cavani, but neither of them seemed particularly keen to pass to one another. And you just wonder, when Cavani joined, Laurent Blanc tried to play a 4-4-2 with a diamond midfield with Cavani and Ibra up front, and it just didn't work. And Ibra is so sort of head and shoulders ahead of everyone at PSG in terms of star status. That, you know, Cavani, you worry if he now sort of gets shifted out to the wing, and the goals dry up for him, where's it all going to end? I don't particularly think it's going to end happily for Cavani at PSG.
Is there tension there, Matt? Because, I mean, there was all these kind of reports over the last couple of days about, you know, Cavani and Ibrahimovic, they're not passing to each other, and there just seems to be... Yeah, I mean, is that legitimate? I mean, how much do you think that there's tension between the two? And I mean,
I think there's tension in the PSG dressing room full stop. I think you've got... It's been happening for quite a while now. You've got the Ibra clan, and then you've got the sort of Thiago Silva clan, and the French lot. And Cavani seems a little bit of a loner, to be honest. But yeah, it's interesting hearing players like Christophe Jallet, who left PSG to join Lyon, and he was saying last week that, you know, he'd lost kind of that love of the game because the dressing room just wasn't fun, and you know, no one's kind of allowed to talk unless Ibra gives you the nod. It kind of feels a bit like that, and maybe, you know, this is what it's like. And you know, when you've got a dressing room full of stars, and the lesser names or the team players, whatever you like, have to get used to that. But there is tension, and it's been tough for Laurent Blanc this season. But he's weathering the storm, and you know, that was a big result. I mean, it may seem a bit paradoxical saying he's weathered the storm. PSG, I think, are the only unbeaten team in Europe, along with Chelsea, in the big five leagues. But they've drawn six Ligue 1 games against teams they should be wiping the floor with. And, you know, OK, they beat Barcelona and Marseille, but a couple of bad results, and Blanc will immediately be under pressure again.
I recently read Ibra's biography, and as far as sports bios go, it's pretty good. It really is, and it's obviously Ibra being Ibra, and the one theme is that wherever he goes, he does become, as you mentioned, that man. It becomes, he almost transcends the locker room, at least according to his words, whatever that means. You know, we know where Ibra operates here, but is he happy at PSG? I know he's, you know, obviously approaching the end of his career. He says he's got maybe a couple of years left, but the one theme is that he doesn't stay long at very many clubs. Do you think he'll end his career at PSG?
Well, I mean, he's said that this will be his last sort of big club, or his last, you know, club where he'll be competing for Champions League honours. So, you know, suggests that maybe, you know, he could go to the US, or I don't know, to Asia, or I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying the US is a terrible league. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, it's all right. Don't worry.
But yeah, the level at PSG is very high. I think he's happy. I think he's enjoying life in Paris, and I think, like you say, he's enjoying being the undisputed top dog. I mean, that was the one thing that, you know, the one blip you could say on his sort of club career was the year at Barcelona where Messi didn't let him become the top dog, and that was never really going to end happily. So look, I think going to England, I think that ship has passed. I don't think Ibra wants to go to England. He's played for the big Italian clubs. He's played for Barcelona. I think PSG are lucky they've still got him. You know, fingers crossed that this heel injury doesn't come back, because there's concern that it's something that may sort of now sort of, you know, reoccur. But I think PSG will get at least a couple more good seasons out of him, and the aim, of course, is to win the Champions League. There's some doubt as to whether the team this season is capable of doing that, because I'm not convinced that they are better than they were last year, and they came up short in the quarters against Barcelona last year. But yeah, when you've got Ibra, you've got, you know, the Brazil centre half pairing, you've got Matuidi and Verratti and Motta is an excellent midfield trio. You never know. But to answer your question, I think Ibra's very happy, I think, with PSG.
We're talking to France-based broadcaster Matt Spiro here on the Soccer Central podcast. It's interesting, Matt, in all those great names that you just mentioned there, one that was absent was Johan Cabaye. He's been in and out of the side since joining from Newcastle in January. And now there's rumblings that he isn't happy and that he wants to leave come the January transfer window. Why do you think it hasn't made out for him, or hasn't worked out for him at PSG?
Yeah, I mean, he's been in and out of the side. He's been mainly out of the side.
Yeah.
The thing is, he's a you know, I think Kabay is an excellent player, but there wasn't really any room for him when they bought him, because PSG had this settled midfield three. Laurent Blanc obviously wanted another established midfielder in, you know, in case of injuries, but the, you know, the trio of Motta, Verratti and Matuidi have been largely injury free, and he's been used in different roles by Laurent Blanc. I mean, he's filled in for Motta as the sort of central holding midfielder, which is the role he plays with France. And he's also played on the right-hand side of the trio. And he just he's really struggled. I mean, in the beginning, he looked something like the Yohan Cabaye that we knew from the Premier League. But steadily, his performances have got worse and worse. And he played against Lorient last weekend, and it was
dreadful.
It was like watching an amateur playing in a, you know, in a professional game. And it was quite sad to see. And people were going crazy saying, you know, why is Laurent Blanc leaving on the pitch? He kept losing the ball. He was a liability. But by the same token, he needs to play and he needs to get his confidence up. So it's difficult. And he's made a few comments to suggest that he hasn't been sort of placed in, you know, under the best conditions. And there are two ways of looking at it. You say that PSG haven't really, you know, made life easy for him, but you could also say that he doesn't seem to be up for scrapping for his place. And I think Yohan Cabaye needs to be playing. He's a first choice France player, but he won't be for much longer if he continues to play a very peripheral role at PSG. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him perhaps moving back to England as early as January, because I know he still has a very strong reputation in England, and it's probably a league that suits him better than any other.
Must be awful, though, sitting back and watching Newcastle soar up the table as they are right now. What could have been, I imagine he's thinking to himself. You mentioned the France national team. They're back in action this weekend, having to sit by and watch real matches, real qualifying, of course, as a hosting Euro 2016. They're playing Albania and Sweden. Is it still... I know Deschamps called up a couple of new faces for this squad. Is it still the experimental stage, or is he pretty much saying what he knows and what he has going into Euro in 2 years' time?
He's pretty much sticking with what he saw at the World Cup. He started the first friendly post-World Cup with exactly the same starting 11 that lost to Germany in the quarterfinals. He has brought in a few new faces, as you say. That's largely been inflicted upon him due to injuries, and it's looking, it's not a closed shop, but it's sort of 16 or 17 names are pretty much already down for Euro 2016, and there's only a few places up for grabs, you know, probably, you know, one of the centre-back spots, one of the centre-forward spots, but, you know, a bit of a battle for left-back if Patrice Evra fades away, which could happen. He's just brought up Levin Kurzawa, which has caused a bit of a stir. I don't know if you followed what happened in the under-21 playoff at all, but France basically messed it up against Sweden. Kurzawa scored what he thought was the winner in the last minute. He's a Monaco left-back, this guy. Very good young player, but a bit of an attitude issue, and he was going and mocking the Swedish players, and a minute later Sweden scored, and they went and mocked him. So Deschamps basically said, I'm not picking any of the under-21s, effectively, because they shamed themselves.
Well.
But then another left-back, Tremelinas, got injured, so he's just called up Kuzawa. So, you know, it's mainly sort of four or five fringe sort of positions, places on you know, in the squad. But the backbone of the team is very much in place, and I think that has to be a good thing. You know, the difficulty, though, is keeping everything fresh and keeping people on their toes for 2 years during friendly matches.
Matt, you know, I think one of the reasons why there was such hype around Le Classique yesterday was the fact that, you know, for the first time in a long time, although they're probably not on the same level, but I mean, Marseille was, you know, they entered in just, you know, the two teams were 1 and 2 in the standing. So this was for the first time, in a while, it was really competitive. Yeah. With Marseille kind of, you know, being better for the first time in a long time, how much of that is down to Marcelo Bielsa and the job that he's done since taking over the reins, do you think?
Well, I'd say it's about 99.9% down to Marcelo.
Okay.
No, I mean, what he has done is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal, because he has inherited a fairly average squad. I mean, okay, they're showing that they're perhaps slightly better than average, but I mean, he's got exactly the same group of players as last season's squad. It was a bit of a, you know, okay, Roman Alessandrini's come in. They've made a couple of minor signings. Alessandrini's not even first choice usually. And he has got this team that for much of last season looked like no-hopers. They finished seventh, and it was a messy old season. They've got this team playing like, okay, world beaters is perhaps an exaggeration, but they start games like they're just dying of hunger. They sprint about, they press high up the pitch, and they're just kind of suffocating teams. And I find it fascinating because you're seeing the influence of a coach, and purely the influence of a coach, because he's got them playing in a very fluid sort of system whereby it's effectively a back four, but you've got Romão in the holding midfield, and as soon as the opposition play with two up, Romão just slots back in and makes it a defensive five or three, if you want, with the wing backs. He's got the wing backs when they don't have the ball tucking into central midfield and doing man to man marking. It's fascinating tactically to watch, and what he's done. He's revived a whole group of players. He's got them believing. Now the big question marks is can it last? Because he's getting them to work extremely hard. I mean, I interviewed Steb Mondondo, the captain, before the Clasique, and he said, look, we don't enjoy ourselves during the week. It's not much fun. We just basically, repeat these training ground drills and whatever, but the weekends are just fantastic, and we have such a great time on the pitch, and we're loving life, and as long as that continues, I don't mind suffering a bit during the week. And frankly, when you're earning the sort of money these guys are doing, I think you should be working hard and suffering a bit.
I love that.
It's interesting to say, it's not fun anymore during the week, but because they're winning, but he's really making them work very hard, and you saw in the first, after the first half yesterday, they'd given so much. It was always going to be hard when they went in 1-0 down, and it's been in the last few games they have looked a bit tired, and the squad is very, very light. That's the thing. He's been using the same starting 11 week in, week out. Luckily for Marseille, they don't have Europe to worry about, so they've only got Ligue 1. And for the sake of Ligue 1, I hope they can sort of keep it up. They're still a point above PSG, but it's been a really fascinating experience for me to see what Bielsa has managed to do in a few months.
I love it when footballers complain about Monday to Friday. Now, I've got to train, now I'm going to play football. Awful, isn't it? Reality, yeah. I tell you. I want to quickly mention a former Marseille player, actually, Frank Ribéry, obviously of Bayern Munich, retired, as far as we know, from France, although Michel Platini says he's not allowed to retire from France. What is the latest with this? Is the weirdest thing to me, where Platini thinks he can actually say and control when a player retires, when he doesn't retire.
Well, I mean, I think everyone knows you're not going to force a player to come. Deschamps was the first person to come out and say, look, I've read what you've read, I've read what Frank said, but I'm the France coach, and I decide who gets picked. And I think I'm kind of on Deschamps' side here. I mean, Frank Ribéry is still relatively young. He's 30, close to his best level at the moment. Of course, you can't make the guy not, you can't make the guy come. But by the same token, Deschamps wants to have the best players available. And it's all well and good Frank Ribéry saying, I've given my best, thanks very much, and just sort of waits for all the tributes in the newspaper. But he could still serve his country, and that's the point. And I think Platini's supporting him because Platini's probably wary of the fact that we're seeing more and more players sort of retiring at 31, 32, or even younger sometimes. And that's not particularly good for international football. Of course, Frank Ribéry won't come back for France. I mean, things can change, can't they?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a shame because they're hosting, Euro 2016, and you want your star names there. And it's, you can understand Philipp Lahm and other players from Germany, retiring at the very summit, but that's not what Ribéry's doing.
Do you think that Deschamps would, say, for example, a month before Euro, and Ribéry goes, I've taken a couple of years off now from international play, I'm rested, yeah, sure, I'll play now. Would Deschamps welcome him back at that point? I mean, it is Ribéry, he's obviously arguably the best player.
I don't think he would. Deschamps has shown he's a very strong-minded manager, and he puts the group, the collective, before any individual. That's something that Dominic and Laurent Blanc had trouble doing, and Deschamps by leaving out Samir Nasri, for example, poor old Nasri, he's always the example. By leaving out this this supposed...
Never
supposed
say poor old Nasri.
Well, because he always gets stick, doesn't he? And,
yeah, he deserves it, doesn't
but
he?
But he deserves it, Matt.
I think so. I mean, I've seen, you know, not obviously not a close, you know, close hand. I've not been in the dressing room, but I've seen enough evidence to suggest that he's been a disruptive influence in the couple of tournaments that he has been involved in. And, you know, Ribery, you're talking about a player who's probably a slightly higher level player than Samir Nasri even. But yeah, like I say, Deschamps has been very clear that he'd rather play a player like Moussa Sissoko if he's going to give everything and be totally committed and not disrupt it, you know, his game plan, than pick a prima donna who might cause problems. So no, bringing a player like Ribery a month before, I don't think that would happen. I think it'd have to be at least 6 months to sort of say, right, you know, we're preparing now, so we need our players, we need all our players.
Matt, before we let you go, interested to get your takes on two teams very quickly. Bordeaux, looking very sort of revitalized. Interested to hear your take on their renaissance. And on the other end, Monaco kind of struggling in mid-table. How do you account for that?
Well, Bordeaux, again, a little bit like Marseille, they haven't really improved or changed their squad. Willy Sagnol has come in. He's had a really positive impact. He's a very bright young coach. He spent a lot of his career with Bayern Munich, having already played for Monaco and Saint-Etienne, and did a decent job during his 1 year with the France under-21s. People were disappointed that he left that job to join Bordeaux. So I think he's a good, young, progressive coach. I think he's one to look out for. There's been a massive story in the last week after he spoke to a newspaper and was talking about African players and the fact that he's very wary of having African players because of the African Nations Cup, essentially. And he was then a little bit careless in a few comments in describing a typical African player being cheap, physical, ready for a fight, but not intelligent. And he meant tactically intelligent.
Jeez.
And he went on to say, you know, you've got Scandinavians who are fighters, and you know, in my team, I need a mix of all these qualities, and it's a bit like French society. So you know, they weren't such nasty racist comments, but you know, the sentence got isolated. And when Cheikh Diabaté scored at the weekend, Cheikh Diabaté, their Malian striker, he and all the players ran over to Willy Sagnol, and Sagnol spent the rest of the first half crying on his bench. So it's been an emotional sort of week at Bordeaux, but. That's a long story. They're doing quite well, but their squad is also small, and they don't quite have the quality that Marseille have. So probably top four would be excellent. Top five wouldn't be bad, I'd say, for Bordeaux. Monaco were obviously dealt a massive blow when they decided to sell Falcao and James, as well as some other reasonably important players like Obadi and Riviere, and basically replace them with nobody. It's a real about turn in the Russians' sort of policy of big spending, and nobody's quite sure why it's happened. I think financial fair play regulations is one of the reasons. The Russian owner Rybolovlev's already paid some pretty hefty fines because he's paid 50 million just to be allowed to keep Monaco outside France, which is a massive benefit for tax reasons. And he didn't want to, you know, chuck millions at UEFA, basically. He's also had a very costly divorce. He's also been a bit unwell. So there's a lot of uncertainty around Monaco at the moment. And the coach that they brought in is a young Portuguese coach, Leonardo Jardim, who has made some fairly peculiar decisions. He's doing a little bit better now, but he's also totally changed the way he wanted the team to play, because the player said to him, look, forget it. He wanted to play. It was a bit like Villas Boas at Tottenham and Chelsea before that. You know, we're going to press high up the pitch, we're going to have our defence, except we had Ricardo Carvalho and a couple of other not particularly pacey defenders, and the players said, look, stop it. We can't play like this. So they've changed the way they're playing, and results have improved a little bit. But yeah, Monaco, again, they're going to have their work cut out to sort of get up in the Champions League places.
It's a fascinating story, Monaco, isn't it? Has been for a while now, especially with FFP coming in. Matt, as always, great job. Really enjoyed that. Hope to chat to you real soon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
That's Matt Spiro at Matt Spiro is where you can find him on Twitter.
Great
the
guy.
Authority on French soccer, which is there's so many great storylines in French soccer, isn't
there?
It?
Are, you know,
it kind of falls out the usual talk from the big four leagues, but there's always, and I think PSG's emergence back again, and even Monaco the last few years too, has really put that league back on the map as far as talking points are concerned anyway.
Well, and Bielsa, like he's, as I kind of mentioned, he's kind of revitalized Marseille. So for the first time in a long time, it's, it looks like it could be a title race between those two. And I think I was looking at the standings. There's only 4 points like separating the top 5 or 6 teams. So it's, you know, whereas, you know, in other leagues, teams are starting to pull away. Like, I'm sure we'll talk about Chelsea in a minute. But, you know, so that's great to see. And, yeah, I've long been an admirer of French football. And I think you're right, James. There's a lot of positives going on. And to say nothing of the national team, too, right?
Yeah,
they seem to have found their way after some lean years. So
they were one of the surprises of the World Cup.
Yeah.
I thought they were one of the most impressive teams in the group phase.
And they've got some, like, dearth of, like, quality young talent. Like I'm really high on Pogba, not just because he's Juventus, but I think he's one of the bright prospects and stars in the game. So this is going to be a team that's going to be very good for a long time, I think.
And they play Saka at center back for some reason. It's amazing.
Yeah, that is kind of unusual. Yeah.
But he plays really well for France.
Yeah, no, he does.
But he can't get into the Liverpool team right now. It's a bit odd, but yeah, it's
bizarre.
I mean, that team, you're right. I like France a lot, but when you do host an event, you do lose somewhat from lack of competitive action, you know, in the build-up to it.
You
You probably gain that back from the home support, I would imagine.
But then the home support cuts both ways, right? Because there's all that, you know, psychological pressure to as Brazil found out last summer.
But as you know, France are mentally a very strong team.
I would think so, yeah. And
You think? I'm kidding. Yeah. Really?
And I think
France?
And I think
Deschamps, meltdown artists.
And I think Deschamps is, you know, I think he's kind of come in and changed the culture a little bit there.
Yeah.
So I think that's to his credit, and that's helped the French national team a lot in the last couple of years.
He represents that era of French football when there were few stronger mental teams and talent-laden teams in world football. You know, that 98 and 2000 France team.
He was vital to those two teams. I mean, everyone talks about Zidane and Henri, and absolutely, no question. But Didier Deschamps,
he was a glue.
Absolutely.
Great player.
He was a great player. Both for club and country.
Oh, but didn't play very well for Chelsea.
No, for Juventus he played well, so that's all I care about.
I love that one. Oh, dude, Deschamps, man, he couldn't even, you know, get you. Shut up. He was over the hill by that point.
By that point, yeah, it's, I know,
exactly.
Come on.
Exactly, but I hate when people, like, you know, remember a player from his, you know, few games at a club late in his career. He's a Juventus player.
He was a Juventus. Even before that, at Marseille, he was great.
Yeah.
When he was at Juventus, I mean, honestly, he was top 5 midfielder in the world easily. He was sensational, regardless of what Eric Cantona had to say about him.
And he made Grey cool before George Clooney and John Molinaro.
That's true. He did.
Right?
Yeah. That's true.
By the way, podcast listeners, if you listen to Thursday's podcast, we were raving about J-Mo's beard. It's gone.
It's gone, yeah.
Is that the result of the likes of me and Dobby, you know, pronouncing you the bearded wonder? You then shave it off straight away?
I got to look good for the women. No, it's...
Well,
it's
Roy Keane does it for himself. So
yeah, that's true.
Married,
no,
actually,
you know what it was? It just got to be too much. It was
just itchy?
Yeah, it was itchy. It was
just itchy,
like,
eh?
Yeah, and I was like, I kind of caught myself in the mirror. I was like, boy, you really look like a hobo. So it's...
On my vacation this summer, I didn't shave for like 5 weeks.
Really?
And went for the vacation beard. Wife hated it.
Really?
And I didn't mind it. I like, you know, being unkempt, but more gray than I thought, and got so friggin' itchy towards the end, I had no choice but to get rid of it.
I'm surprised she let you go 5 weeks. That's wow.
I know. Well, you know, we're traveling around Italy with our kid in tow.
Well, when in Rome, then?
There was no romance. So you said that point was...
Well, when in Rome. So you fit in right well with all that.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Anyway, listen, let's get some Premier League talk, eh? And pretty soon we'll be talking some Serie A with Adam Digby.
Yes.
But before then, the Premier League weekend that was... Great weekend for Chelsea, given what happened around them. Arsenal losing.
Right.
Man City drawing. Southampton, they got another win. Swansea, of course, beat Arsenal. They're now 5th in the table. Hammers drew. They're still very much in contention. So those little great stories are still floating around there with Swansea, West Ham, and Southampton. But really, with Arsenal losing, City drawing, you know, Liverpool, you know, losing obviously to Chelsea, and Spurs losing as well. I mean, my God, is anyone going to mount a challenge? Please, someone step up and be a man here. It's going to be boring. It is. It's going. You know what? The championship race is going to be boring by Christmas because Chelsea are going to run away with this thing. No one else wants it.
Well, there's actually a great article today on sportsnet.ca by Ethan Dean Richards, and he kind of talks about how, you know, Chelsea is really the only complete team in the Premier League. When you look at it, they're stacked at every sort of position, and even mm-hmm. in their backups. The fact that Peter Cech can't get a game, I mean, I think that says it all. So, yeah, I fear, like you, James, I fear by Christmas that this could essentially be over. Because what's their lead now? I think 8 points or something like that?
Yeah, let me just quickly check here. But yes, but I was 4 points on Southampton.
Okay, but assuming they're going to fade away.
To Southampton,
right. So what are they over Man City?
Over Man City, it is 8 points. Yeah, and more importantly, over Arsenal, it's 12 points.
Right.
And Arsene Wenger went as far as saying, "It's over with.
Right,
can't catch him." It's 11 games in, Arsene.
Well, I don't think Chelsea can catch them, and I know it's only 11 games in, but
no, Arsenal can't catch him. Of course not. He's completely speaking the truth. But you don't say that.
Oh, I see. What not you're
11
saying.
Games in.
Yeah. Well.
Man, that bloody Arsenal team.
Yeah, you know?
And again, you can play, oh, we lost the game in the middle of the park. That's where you always lose games.
Yeah.
Since Patrick Vieira was there, you've been losing games in that part of the field. Do something about it.
You know what? It's interesting you bring that up, because I really feel that they've never, it's hardly original thought, but I don't think they've really kind of been the same since, you know, Vieira left for Juventus in 2005.
There was the muscle.
Yeah.
And that's not to underestimate his powers. He was far more than muscle. He was one of the great midfielders, but he provided that steel and that spine.
Yeah.
And when he left, they haven't even tried. I mean, Alex Song was that way and could have been that way for a while, but he left for Barcelona.
Right.
They could have signed him back again. Didn't.
Yep.
Went to West Ham, playing really well. I mean, listen, we've been through this over and over at Arsenal. I know we have their limitations, but for God's sakes.
They could use someone like Kevin Strootman or...
Or, a lot of teams could.
Well, yeah.
When he's healthy, he hasn't played for a year. But
coming back, though. Mm-hmm. But I think, Arsenal would definitely benefit from a guy like that, like a box-to-box midfielder who can create and destroy at the same time.
There aren't many of them.
No, there's
very
not.
Few. Very few. But it's just frustrating. But good for Swansea. Fifth place, Gary Monk, English manager. That's
great. Right.
We can't celebrate him and say he's great and he's savvy because he's English. You know, that's not the cool. It's not the cool thing to do, right?
Right.
You know, Gary Monk. He can't be successful. Shrewd signings at Swansea.
Yeah.
And you know, very quietly, they're moving up the table here. Wilfred, fifth place.
Wilfred Bony, I think, has been just a fantastic signing for them.
He might re-sign as well. He said, I think today or yesterday, he said that he's been tempted to leave the club.
Really?
But he's close now to signing. Maybe after the break.
Oh, okay.
Which is a
that'd be
fantastic.
Huge. That'd be huge for the Swans. I've got a soft spot for them ever since. The couple of years ago when they won the League Cup and they were playing really attractive football and, they had Michu and all those guys in the height of their powers. I thought they were just one of the most fun teams to watch.
John de Guzman doing a great job there. Who scored a hat-trick? Last week.
In the Europa League,
Yep, crazy. Other games, quickly, I mentioned City drew QPR, boy. City in crisis. Would you call it crisis
now?
It's 11 games in, but that's over a quarter of the season.
I wouldn't call it crisis, but I mean, if I'm Manuel Pellegrini, I'm certainly a little bit worried about job security because potentially by Christmas, they could be both out of the Champions League and possibly out of Europe altogether and be, double-digit lead gap behind Chelsea. This in spite of having... I wouldn't say on paper as good a team as Chelsea, but not that far off.
It's not far off, no, not at all.
So, I mean, there's really sort of no excuse. And I've been racking my brain as to what the issue is. I'm guessing it's just psychological because there's really no sort of reason why they shouldn't be, a lot closer and achieving in Europe as well.
Well, I mean, the talent's there, obviously. And you look at the balance of the team, that's there as well. They have the defensive midfielders. They have the creative midfielders. They have the goal scorers. They have a decent back four. They got depth.
Yeah.
There is no weakness, really, that says that's why they're losing games, other than, you're right, mental. And maybe this disharmony, maybe it's an unhappy room. I don't know.
Man.
But, I mean, what other reason would there be?
I mean, I don't think it's unfair to say that Yaya Toure, and I don't buy this whole business about him being, lazy or anything like that. I just think but that at the same time, I do think he hasn't been up to his usual standards.
I don't think
he's not the same player as he was the last couple of years, for whatever reason that might be. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that his brother, or was it?
His brother died. Brother.
So that's probably weighing on his mind.
Sure.
So he's been off the mark. And I think Sergio Aguero, when he wants to be, he can be the most dynamic, lights-out player in the Premier League. Like, game changer. Like, absolutely the best player in the Premier League when he wants to. And, he certainly had an influence at Loftus Road on Saturday, but I think we haven't seen that nearly enough.
Mm-hmm. He's not the kind of player that will throw the team on his shoulders. He's a guy that you won't see all game, then you'll see the score sheet and he's got two goals.
Right.
Right, which, listen, that's a sniper.
And that's fine.
That's great, but you want more from him.
Yeah, I would just want it on a more consistent basis.
12 goals leading the charts so far. As long as he does that, that's all that matters. You can't really blame him, I think, for the team's failings.
No, absolutely
not. It goes further back than that. But that being said, one of his goals, how it counted, I don't know, in the first
which
half. The one that was a handball and he was offside in the same play.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah. Right.
But we'll count that anyway. Sure. There you go, Kuhn.
The second one was nice, though. The pass out of the back from Toure and the way he controlled that and then slotted it home.
Toure, it's funny you mentioned Toure, and he's been poor, yeah, no doubt about it, but I think he's had more successful passes than anyone else in the league this season.
Really?
He gets the ball a lot.
Mm.
But you're right, he hasn't been that. Maybe it's unfair to hold him to last season's heights because he was so brilliant last season.
Right.
He's one of the best players in world football. And he's now in his, 32 round there?
Yeah, but that's far from over the hill. And yeah, I mean, and that's...
At some point, you're going to drop off.
Sure, absolutely. But that's the burden of being a great player is that, what you did last year or the previous campaign, it's like, yeah, that's fine, but what are you doing this year? I mean...
So it's one thing playing badly, but it's when you lose a plot. Last week in Champions League, that was just stupidity.
Wow, that was...
So he's obviously under pressure. But whatever the reason is, we discussed it before. We don't know what's happening inside Yaya Toure's head right now.
Right.
Obviously, it's been a very trying few months.
Sure.
Personally. But, if you have to step back a bit and take some games off, do that because you're hurting your team.
And maybe he's, unsettled at the club, right? I mean, that whole business with his agent and the birthday thing.
Don't get me started.
But there's probably more to that than we know or think. So, I mean, maybe there's things going on.
He may just be a weird baby.
But maybe there's things going behind the scenes that we don't know about and he's just being unsettled.
Be professional.
I agree, James. I agree.
He's making reportedly £250,000 a week. All right. I don't care if you're unhappy with your contract situation. You're making that much money. You're one of the highest paid players in world football. Right. That's a pretty good contract.
It is. No doubt.
Anyway, it's all speculation. Maybe he's very happy with his contract. I don't know. It could be his agent spinning things, right?
Could be.
All right. Well, let's switch gears now and talk some Italian Serie A. The old lady's back. Juve 7. Parma nil this past weekend, an absolute rout. We're now joined by Adam Digby. He knows a thing or two about the Serie A. Adam, how you doing, mate?
How are you?
Good man. Admit it, you're very, very happy. Your boys crushed Parma 7-0 this past weekend. Back on track, I guess. I read a great article by Paolo Bandini this morning talking about Carlos Tevez. And he wasn't comparing him to Alex Del Piero, who celebrated the big 4-0 this weekend somehow. It's crazy, he's 40. But still, Tevez is playing some really good football for Juve right now and is, I guess, really winning over the fan base.
Yeah, definitely so. He's obviously a very, very different player to Alessandro Del Piero and a different temperament and a different background too. But he's taken the number 10 shirt from Del Piero and it's really been without controversy, which is quite strange when you think how much Del Piero meant to the Juve fans and still continues to mean, really. He's just been superb and we've had none of the hassles that we saw before with Roberto Mancini at Manchester City and all the drama that went with Tevez there. There's just been none of that. It's just been goal after goal, really, and good performance after good performance. He's just been excellent. He scored twice on Sunday and that was his first goals in six games, so it was good to see him back on track as well as the team as a whole.
Juventus flying high in Serie A, Adam. Only one loss, top of the table, coming off that big win against Parma on the weekend where they were just, splendid to watch. I mean, they were just all over Parma from every sense of the word. So obviously flying high domestically, but in Europe, laboring a little bit, albeit in a somewhat difficult group with Atletico Madrid. But how do you account for, their two forms, the flying form in Italy, but as I said, laboring a bit in the Champions League.
I think it's a few factors, really. I think the flying at home domestically missed a struggle to a few results. The win over Roma wasn't without its controversy, and then they drew with Sassuolo, beat Palermo easily, and then obviously they had that loss to Olympiacos, which all came in a bit of a bad run. I don't think the 3-5-2 is well suited to Serie A. I think to the Champions League. I think the fullbacks get pressured too much because most teams in Europe play with a lot of attacking width, and that really makes the team struggle because Lichtstein and Asamoah have been so key to everything positive about Juve in recent seasons. And then I think that change in tactics has really helped. I think we saw in the first half against Olympiacos, before they scored from a set piece. I think we saw a much better and a much brighter Juve, just like we did this past weekend when they played with four at the back again. And I really do think that's going to be the way to go. Like we said, that he tried to continue with Conte's 3-5-2, but the team needed a bit of a shake-up, and that's why he'd opted to make the change now. And obviously that paid off against Parma, as poor as Parma are at the moment. But I think we will take a lot of confidence and a lot of belief from that moving forwards. And with Malmo up next in the Champions League, hopefully be another comfortable 3 points and another performance like we saw Sunday. And then it goes back to the last game against Atletico Madrid, which hopefully they'll be qualified. And then Juve can obviously make their way through to the knockout stages, which they missed last year.
What about Andrea Pirlo, Adam? Because I think he's someone who, obviously a legendary player, everyone thinks the world of him, but at 34 or 35, I don't think it's that much of a stretch to say his best days are behind him. How do you see him fitting in with Juve once he comes back from injury? Is it time to maybe phase him out a little bit?
I don't know. I think we saw Milan write him off far too early, and there's absolutely right. no chance of me doing the same thing. Allegri, again, has spoken about Pirlo at length quite recently, and he was saying that he missed the pre-season because of his hip injury. And I think that really can't be underestimated, the effect that that's had on him, and he's really struggled to get back to anywhere near his best since then. I think with the international break and then a couple of games off, it could do him some good, and he could get back to his best. Well, maybe not his best, but the best we can expect from him at the age that he's at. And he's still got a lot to offer. I think the way that he controls the tempo and the way that he dictates the game is still essential for you. And the understanding he's got with a few players, he's built up a good rapport with Tevez. He's brilliant at picking out Lichtsteiner with those longer raking passes that we see from the centre of the pitch. And that's still a big, big weapon for you, Ben. I think we'll see that some more. But he obviously is on his way out. He's not going to last more than another one or two seasons, I won't imagine. But he's still, like I say, he's still a fine player, and he still has so much to offer that it's hard to say how he's fading out, because he's so much is built around him and his style that it's difficult to just abandon that and just keep moving. But I think we've seen Juve play well without him, and hopefully they'll continue to play well whether he's in the side or not.
Meanwhile, Napoli, they win again, beat Fiorentina this weekend, up to third place in the table. I guess that the crisis is over. However, they are now missing Lorenzo Insigne for maybe 6 months, as he blew his knee out this past weekend. How big a loss is it to Napoli, and are they going to contend, you think, with Juve by when all said and done for this title?
I think they can do. Obviously, they had a poor start to the season. They only won once in their first four games, but they've not lost since then. And they're a very, very good side. The way that they play under Rafa Benitez is very good to watch. And their attacking talent, like the Callejon especially, and Gonzalo Higuain, are dangerous for anybody. I think Insigne is a good player, and he's somebody that you're going to miss. But when you look that they've got Hamsik and they've got Dries Mertens, and they're not in the Champions League, they're only in the Europa League, as much as you don't want to say that. But they're still going to play their best side in the league, and they should be able to challenge. And they've made up a lot of ground on Roma over the past few weeks, and it looks like they could challenge for the title again. I think, yes, they will miss Insigne because he is a good player, but they do have other players in that position, so it's not as big a problem as it might have been for some other side.
Do you have a theory, Adam, and I'm sure you do, about why Inter Milan is struggling this year?
Mm-hmm. I try and put my bias aside. it's really difficult to explain, because you look at Milan, and obviously, they're struggling too, but they've still got Silvio Berlusconi, and Inter have got a new foreign owner, and you think that that should be a positive. And then Walter Mazzarri is quite a well-respected coach, and he's a successful coach as well, even if that's within certain limits. They don't really push on to the title, but he's good at building a contender, and we've not really seen that. I think the problem at the moment for them seems to be just the disjointed nature of their squad. People have been mourning for years that, much like their neighbours Milan, they were holding on to ageing players for much too long. And we saw the likes of Wallace Samuel and Esteban Cambiasso stay there perhaps a little bit too long. And then they just lost them all at once. Cordoba retired, Zanetti retired. Obviously, Cambiasso moved to Leicester. Samuel left, Diego Milito left. And I think that left a real void of leadership on the pitch. And you see Andrea Ranocchia now as the club captain. And as good a defender as he will become one day, I think, and as important as he is to that side right now, I would never have marked him out as a potential leader and as a captain for anybody, really, let alone a club as big and as grand as Inter. And obviously, it did not help by the fact that Vidic has struggled so much. So I think it's just a bit of a process they're going through, gelling a little without those veteran stars and trying to find some leaders on the field as they are at the moment. I think that all the things seem to be there. There's a lot of talent in that squad. It remains to be seen whether Attar is the man to take them forward. But I think they've got all the right things going on there. They're just not happening for them right now.
Parma, obviously bottom of the table, their misery compounded by that 7-0 loss in Turin. How worried should Roberto Doni be about his future at the club?
I think he should be very worried. They're really, really struggling this season. They've won two games and lost the other nine. They've got the worst defensive record in the league, obviously not helped by getting 7 foot past them on Sunday, but they're really struggling. They're unfortunate because they've got Mattia Cassani and Gabriel Paletta both out injured. I think both of them played once so far this season, maybe twice. And when they only play a back three and they've lost two of their starting three players there, that's obviously going to be a concern, and it's obviously left them in a bit of a mess at the back. There was a report in Gazzetta dello Sport this morning that Donadoni was going to be fired over the international break, but that was conflicted by Gianluca Di Maggio saying that he won't be. He'll be given a little bit more time. And I think it really does depend on whether they hold Donadoni accountable or how long they can manage to not hold him accountable, if you like. And that report in Gazzetta linked Hernan Crespo as a potential successor, and he's already on the staff of the club and obviously a legend there at Parma. And that might be interesting to see, and see how his career would develop if he was given such a chance.
Yeah, for sure. Adam, I see AC Milan now sitting down in seventh place. They've scored 20 goals, which isn't so bad, actually. 16 against, not great. Pipo Inzaghi, of course, came in amidst much fanfare. He signs Fernando Torres. He has one goal so far. What is the general consensus on Milan under Inzaghi and Torres? Is he really just finished and done?
Torres is really struggling. I'm quite surprised, to be honest. I thought it might just be the right thing to reignite his career, coming to Serie A, where there's a little bit more space and a little bit less frenetic pace. He thought he'd be able to just pick his spots and be able to open up some of these defences. But he's really not done that. He struggled just as he did at Chelsea, and it's getting to the stage where you have to think it's not a case of it's just bad form. It's just that's the player that he is at today. The injuries have really slowed him, and he's really struggling to make an impact. I think Milan overall, unlike Inter, they're still relying on that old-fashioned leadership from Silvio Berlusconi, but they've got a lot of promising young players, again, like Inter, that they're going to take time to develop. But you saw Stefan El Shaarawy score for the first time in nearly 2 years this past weekend, and he's going to be a vital figure for them moving forward. And they've got some other good younger players further back as well. They've still got some gaping holes in the squad, and they just seem to be unable to field a stabilised lineup, really. They've had so many chopping and changing in defence that's where their problems seem to lie. They've got Adil Rami, who's been really good for them when he's managed to play, and Alex has looked okay. It's the likes of Bonera, who was sent off this past weekend, and Christian Zapata. They've really, really struggled, and I think the more that Inzaghi has to call upon those players through injuries and suspensions, that's when Milan have suffered, because they just don't have the depth to cover for those losses, and it's really hurting their chances now.
Turning our attention to the national team, Adam, Italy plays Croatia on Sunday in a crucial Euro 2016 qualifier. And interestingly, Antonio Conte has recalled Mario Balotelli into the national team setup. What do you think of that decision in light of Balotelli's struggles at Liverpool this year?
I think it's quite a smart move from Conte there, because I think with getting the four wins already, he's earned the credit to do whatever he wants, really, with Italy. He's rebuilt their reputation a little bit from the disaster at the World Cup. And I think calling Balotelli back now, Croatia is a tough game, but it doesn't, because three teams are probably going to go through, which it's really difficult to see Italy not qualifying after the start that they've had. And calling him back now puts
you know, when is Mario Balotelli going to be back in the squad? Sort of questioning, and it really puts an end to the drama for now, because there always seems to be drama around Mario Balotelli. I don't think he fully deserves it at the moment. I wouldn't say he's done anything too special for Liverpool as yet, but like I say, it just sort of draws a line under the fact that he's been excluded until now. And it takes away another question for Conte, because he does bat those things away, and he really doesn't like getting involved in it. So it just draws an end to the speculation, I suppose.
Right. Interesting stuff. Listen, Adam, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And keep up the great work.
Cheers, guys.
Adam Digby, 442 contributor, and lots of other great things. Great guy, eh?
Oh, Adam's great, yeah. Been doing Serie A with him for a long time, actually.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on Italy briefly here under Conte, because the first couple of games, you know, man, people loved it.
Yeah.
Playing great soccer, you know, scoring goals. They've been perfect in qualifying so far. 3 wins, 3 games. But the last two results, including that dour affair against Malta,
they were laboured.
That's the word, I think. It is laboured performances, but getting the results.
I think, look, it's still early in his tenure. I think, yeah, as you said, three wins from three games. Would I like them to be a bit more stylish and dominating the performances? Sure. But this is, and I hate to use this cliched expression, but it really is a marathon, right? So, I mean, if they're like this, you know, a couple months out to Euro in 2016, then I'm a little bit worried. Right now, I'm willing to give Conte some time. And I will say this. I do think Italy's playing much more sort of passionately and with more heart and more character under Conte. And I think that's because of him, because that's the type of coach he is and it's the type of player he was, right? He demands the best of his players, whether he was a player at Juventus or the national team. And so I think that's encouraging to see.
Although they were playing that kind of football when Prandelli first took over as well. You know, there's that almost that bounce back new coach kind of bump, isn't it?
They were, but and I'm not suggesting that they weren't sort of committed to the cause, but you could just see that, and maybe I'm overestimating the importance of this, but you can tell that they're playing like with their hearts on their sleeves against Conte.
Right.
Not that they weren't against Prandelli, but I think you can visually see it manifest itself on the field. So I think that's a good thing.
We'll see this week with Bello back in the fold, eh?
Yeah.
If Bello's playing with his heart on his sleeve,
well,
then you know that the coach has the team under control.
Exactly. It'll be interesting to see. Who's England play? Is it Slovenia?
Slovenia, yeah.
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 Are they on the road or are they at home?
That's a good question. I haven't begun my research yet for the weekend.
You're hosting on...
I've got 4 days still.
Come on.
Just my plans this week is to start researching this stuff.
Right.
I know Roy Hodgson's still the manager. Rooney's hitting the 100th cap.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing, really. Wayne Rooney, 100 caps.
Wow, good for him.
Yeah. He's played well in about 3 of them.
That's a bit harsh.
Maybe a little bit, but he hasn't been great. Listen, I saw some video of Euro 2004 when he broke through on the international scene, and this young, confident kid with such swagger playing so well. I remember saying then, wow, forget Owen a few years ago, forget, you know, the Gerard Lamb. This is the future. This is finally a true world-class player on the international scene. And I think you can look back 10 years from then and debate whether he ever reached those heights. I don't think he did.
I was going to say that I remember that 2004 Euro tournament really well, and I think that was his best tournament. He hasn't come close.
Now, he's been hurt in a couple of them,
sure,
in fairness. But just looking at his England career overall, it might be one of these situations where he hasn't had very good teams around him as well. And I think Rooney is, or was, maybe he still is, we're going to find out, but was at his best and fine form a world-class player. He really was. But those England teams haven't been great for a long time.
And I think it's been a while since he's been a world-class player, if I'm being perfectly honest.
I think you could be right there. Like, yeah. It's tough to argue. You know,
anyway, we got to go.
Yeah, I guess so.
Just a reminder that the Premier League is off this week due to the international break. But Sportsnet is going to have comprehensive coverage of the Euro 2016 qualifiers.
Six.
2016, I made a mistake.
I think Germany might win that.
Yeah, exactly. With games every day from Friday to Sunday. James Sherman's going to be hosting. No, you're an analyst, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, well, you and Dobson and Forrest. So, yeah, you'll get to see
the three of us will do something anyway.
They're going to do something. They're going to be hosting the games Friday to Sunday. And so we're showing games every day, including Scotland and Ireland, England versus Slovenia, and Italy versus Croatia. 26 games in total across the Sportsnet platforms. For a full rundown of games, we'll be showing, go to sportsnet.ca and check out the broadcast schedule, and you can pick what game you want to watch. And of course, James and I will be back next Monday with another edition of the Soccer Central podcast. Until then, Thanks for listening.